President Bush and President Bush repeatedly threatened North Korea and Iran. And indeed, there still remains the chance of some kind of combat with Iran. Israel is the US's closest ally. It receives far more economic and military aid than anyone else, yet is required to do very little for this. Indeed, it's given a free hand militarily. Israel felt free to invade Lebanon in 2006 and the Gaza Strip in 2008. Also in 2008, the Georgian government expected American help when it sent troops into the Russian-protected breakaway Republic of Abkhazia. And the President and Congress have verbally supported the Georgians in the ensuing crisis, and so has our present President. The US is installing anti-ballistic missile sites, threatening Russia more than Iran. These are claimed to be defensive, and in a sense, anti-ballistic missiles are defensive. But to the Russians, if the American missiles really can intercept theirs, then Russia lacks deterrence against an American first-strike nuclear war for the first time since the 1940s. This is not quite perpetual war, but it's persistent war and persistent threats. For the US, war seems to be the default mode when diplomacy appears to falter. This is in marked contrast to the world as a whole. Interstate wars have declined almost to zero since World War II. During the last 10 years, there have been no interstate wars which did not involve either the US or Israel. Of course, there remain many civil wars, but they are rarely our concern, or they should rarely be our concern, since potentially hostile powers are rarely involved in them. US military expenditure is also extremely high. U.S. defense spending, you could see World War II, Korea, Vietnam, 1980, I can't read that on the screen.
These are constant dollars too, right?
Yes, constant 2008 dollars. 1980s build up, the 2009 request, sorry, 2008 request that should be, 2009 as well, and you can see we're now the highest in the post-war period, okay? And this is since 2001 in more detail. The yellow is the Iran-Afghanistan wars, Iraq-Afghanistan wars directly. The blue is the basic military budget, which is still going up. U.S. military spending versus the world. U.S. military spending is 48% of the world's entire military spending. 48%. If you look closely, you can see China, you probably can't read it, but it's got 8%, and Russia has 5% in 2008. Okay? The rest of the world would have to gang up on the US for it to be a fairly even contest, as long as high-tech weapons don't count, because the US has a monopoly of them. So that's 48% figure is truly mind-boggling. Of course, these are all approximate figures. Military expenditure is very difficult to work out, even for the US, and for less open states, it's very difficult indeed. Of course, no other power has ever had what the Pentagon has been calling full-spectrum dominance, that is, dominance over air, land, sea, and space. Britain's navy, at the height of its empire, was kept at a two-power standard, equal to the next two navies combined, but its army was weaker than that of several of its rivals. For all these reasons, I think it's justified to call the US a rather militaristic power, prone to resort to war as the default mode of foreign policy. And I'm now going to try and explore a little bit why this is so, though I think it is still somewhat mysterious. I start with a realist approach. The core realist view of the need for armed forces is to defend one's national security interests. This is minimally defined as the defense of the homeland. But that can't be the main explanation here, since the US has never been safer from attack by another state. Indeed, the great progress made in nuclear disarmament in agreement with Russia, and this has carried on through the Bush administration, has greatly reduced the only major threat the US has ever faced in this respect. I'll deal with non-state threats later. But what counts as national defense can become enlarged if we also include allies or empire. If a state has useful allies that might make a contribution to our economy, then it would wish to defend them too. That was certainly true during the Cold War period in Europe, for example. However, this threat has largely disappeared, and allies must be considered as actually adding to U.S. strength. Adding the defense budget of reliable allies of the U.S., like Western Europe, Japan, and South Korea, bring the alliance up to 72% of world expenditure. Of these allies, only South Korea and Taiwan, and Israel if you count it, themselves face any threat today. So realism would expect U.S. military help to be offered to them, but in general, allies don't explain the size and posture of the U.S. military. Now, the second type of enlargement comes with empires, for an imperial state wants to defend its whole empire. Doesn't necessarily make it feel more secure. The British Empire notably got less secure as it got bigger. U.S. dominance in the world is not everywhere imperial, of course. In some parts, it's what we call hegemony, when it's regarded as by the local natives as being legitimate, and this was so in Western Europe, for example. So I'm only discussing cases where military force is applied to foreign territories, which is not regarded as entirely legitimate by most or a substantial part of the natives, and that is imperialism. It needn't involve colonies. It can be what historians call informal empire, where peripheral states, foreign states remain sovereign, but get intermittently disciplined by the imperial power. The U.S. has repeatedly destabilized unfriendly regimes through military interventions or CIA covert ops. It has also propped up friendly client regimes. In this type of empire, success always depends on having native allies on the ground who could form a stable government after any U.S. military intervention. In the Cold War, this was not difficult, for the political right almost always supported the U.S. But it's noticeable that the U.S. was probably least successful in the Middle East. So, of course, was the Soviet Union. The Middle East basically remained rather fragile as far as empires were concerned. The presence of valuable economic resources also increases the desire of empires to intervene. Military pressure is believed to secure better access and deny access to rival powers. Today this means oil, but the problem with oil is that it is in the Middle East, where the U.S. has had most difficulty in finding stable, reliable, and useful client states. Its attempts to find them also eventually produced terrorist blowback. Israel is stable and somewhat reliable, but has no oil and is hated by the actual oil producers. Saudi Arabia has been a loyal ally, but not in public. It has to keep the alliance quiet. The Shah of Iran was fine as he lasted. Saddam was fine for a while as a counterweight to Iran, but both turned sour on the U.S., and the combination of U.S. policies in the Middle East generated blowback from political Islamism, which in the early 1990s was on the rise in general in the region. However, repression by Middle Eastern states broke the back of political Islam, and it's only left in Palestine and South Lebanon. But surviving militants fled abroad and turned most of their activities against the West and the U.S. Bin Laden was the most famous of these. You should remember his three demands: the removal of infidel troops, that's Americans, from the holy places, that's Saudi Arabia. Second, the end of the killing of Iraqi children through U.S. bombing and U.S. sanctions of Iraq. And thirdly, ending U.S. support for the Zionists who were stealing Muslim lands in Israel. And from these demands, we can see that this kind of terrorism directed against the U.S. was mainly blowback against U.S. policy in the Middle East. Nevertheless, such terrorism is real enough. Empires always develop ideological mission statements. Imperialists say they are intervening to bring order, the true word of God, civilization, democracy to the natives. some combination of those. Today, for the U.S., it's sometimes democracy. Those less ambitious imperialists will settle for order. If the U.S. could bring democracy or even order, it might be good for the world. Though all empires worry strategically about possible future decline or vulnerability, this fear has recently escalated due to the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, which are now potentially available to lesser powers like North Korea, Iran, etc. And in principle, they are available to terrorists, non-state organizations. No state currently defined by the U.S. as hostile has weapons which can reach the territory of the United States, though in a few weeks, perhaps, North Korean nuclear missiles might be able to reach Alaska. But of course, what would happen to North Korea if they launched one? It's not really to be thought of. Nor are terrorist suitcase bombs yet reality. But maybe by 2030 or 2030, they will be reality. The U.S. might also fear the rise of China and Russia in the future. So as an empire, perhaps the U.S. does have quite a lot to fear. And indeed, all these imperial motivations could be found in the administration of Bush the Younger. To fight a war against terror, to eradicate threatening weapons of mass destruction, to protect Israel, to secure an ally, Israel, to secure oil, to intimidate future rivals like Russia and China, to bring democracy, or perhaps order, to a notably disorderly and authoritarian region of the world, the Middle East. But we should consider whether these goals have been achieved, and the answer is hardly at all. The effect of threatening North Korea and Iran has on balance been to speed up their acquisition of such weapons. The alternative policy is to buy them out instead, or at least have carrots more than sticks, and the Clinton policy was some mixture of the two, though the U.S. didn't stick to its deal any more than the North Koreans did. Saddam Hussein had no links with terrorists attacking the U.S., but now, of course, there are very many terrorists, such terrorists operating in Iraq, and many more in other countries like Britain and France. Political Islamism was virtually destroyed in the Middle East in the late 1990s, but we have revived it internationally. Both our invasions escalated blowback. There are not many international terrorists, but they are determined, and occasionally they are well organized. Of course, bin Laden was in Afghanistan, but he's not now. He's either in Pakistan or dead. But the war in Afghanistan somehow turned away from targeting Al-Qaeda to targeting the Taliban. Yet the Taliban engage in no activities against the U.S. except in their own homeland, including adjacent regions of Pakistan. They attack us there because we attack them. No more oil has been pumped in Iraq than Saddam managed when he was suffering under UN sanctions. Thus, the invasion has not secured more oil, if that was the intention. Afghanistan has no oil at all, of course. In fact, it has nothing that we want unless we want to go into the drug business, which would be very profitable, of course. The British did that in India and China in the 19th century. Why not us now? But there's now no realist rationale for being in Afghanistan, I believe. However, some have sought an economic rationale for the recent wars, and this map might seem to make their case plausible. Now, 1, 2, 3, 4 are the four wars. One is the first Gulf War. 2 is the Yugoslav Wars. 3, Afghanistan. 4, the present Iraq War. The black symbols are oil installations or natural gas installations. The red airplanes are American bases. Before 1991, there were only 2 U.S. air bases on this map, the 2 in Turkey. Now, they're all over the place. They seem to be ringing the oil and natural gas reserves. Now, many leftists think this is a strategy for dominating the world's natural resources. I'd be interested to know from General Clark if there are any in the Pentagon or the White House who do see this as a serious, though developing, strategy for asserting control of the Middle East, the Caucasus, and Central Asia. Though it may look impressive, it's rather deceptive. It does not secure more oil. The host state is sovereign. The host state can decide whether it wants to continue with the base. And indeed, we've been kicked out of the Saudi bases, the Uzbek state base. We're no longer in the Tajik base, I don't know why. And probably we're right now being ejected from the Kyrgyzstan base. Okay? So we're losing some of them. And in any case, these bases are more useful for global logistics than for intimidating the host state or neighbors. China and the Japanese and the Europeans have made long-term market contracts to receive their Middle Eastern oil without any military default mode. Militarism does not get you more oil. Markets do. There's neither democracy nor much order in Afghanistan, though there is some, and that seems likely to remain so, at least in the near future. In Iraq, there are elections, but this is really an ethnocracy in which most people vote along ethnic religious lines. Stability really depends upon Shia, Sunni, and Kurdish leaders striking deals rather than fighting each other. There is, it is true, now more order in the earlier than in the earlier post-invasion period, but probably still less than there was under Saddam. More have probably died in Iraq as a result of the invasion than Saddam killed. The recent surge worked partly because more US troops were more actively deployed, but more was probably achieved, though one can't be sure, by arming and paying Sunni tribal chiefs to attack insurgents fighting the client government. Now, that arming of them doesn't augur well for democracy. Is Israel securer? Launching, with perhaps American encouragement, or certainly without American interference, launching its own version of persistent war, occupying more lands, creating more eventual blowback. Russia has been alienated by U.S. policy over Georgia and missile sites, and in response is now asserting its rights in its Central Asian backyard, which may well be behind the Kyrgyzstan, the withdrawal of the Kyrgyzstan base. Do we have any security interests in that region, in Central Asia? Can't we leave it to the Russians and Chinese to balance each other, as realists would say? So a realist rationale doesn't provide an explanation, not even when extended into imperialism. It seems to produce more blowback than benefits. So should we instead blame the stupidity, ideology, and mendacity of the Bush administration? It's true that it has exceeded the normal human quotient, a stupid, ideological, and mendacious behavior which characterizes foreign policy as much as any sphere of policy. It's also true that military expenditure had gone down earlier under both Bush the Elder and Clinton. Between 1988 and 1998, it went down by almost a third, though so did almost every other country. General Clark knows only too well how reluctant Clinton had been to actually use this fabulous military, which made his eventual Yugoslav interventions longer than they needed to be. He also refused to make what might have been a very positive intervention in Rwanda. But U.S. military expenditure had actually remained in the range of 40 to 45% of the world since at least 1988. It increased under Bush the Younger, but not enormously. We cannot blame it all on Bush anyway. Almost no one has contested the extraordinary level of military appropriations. In October 2008, a $612 billion military budget slipped through Congress with little debate or publicity. and military items in other budgets added another $100 billion. Now, October 2008 is the same time as Secretary Paulson's notorious $700 billion bailout of the banks, a very similar amount of money, very hotly debated at all, but military appropriations go through uncontested. Does President Obama offer change? In the election debates, he promised he would not cut the military budget. John McCain said he would through eliminating waste and inefficiency and corruption in the military. Obama first said he'd pull all of the troops out from Iran in 16 months, then he said he'd pull most of them out, and now it also depends on circumstances on the ground, which is not an unreasonable position. He promises to double troop numbers in Afghanistan and to bomb Pakistan if necessary. He's not said a word against Israeli actions. He's not indicated that oil is more appropriately a matter for markets than war. And if the markets need nudging, better to make friends rather than enemies of the producers. The Chinese and Japanese provide economic development packages to the Middle East to secure their oil. President Obama has not indicated change on the missile sites or on Georgia. He's not contested the notion of a war against terror, and this notion is reflected in the U.S. military appropriations. Of the appropriations designed to combat terrorism, 90% of them are military and 10% for police, security, or intelligence agencies. Yet terrorism against the U.S. is so small scale, so lacking in general support in the Middle East, that it is more effective to treat these terrorists as criminals and to hunt them down with the help of most of the world's police forces and intelligence agencies. The default mode should not be a war. But of course, President Obama does want to talk to everyone, which is something. But it's more than just Bush or Obama. Militarism seems embedded in American institutions and culture, as well as in the Bush administration. It's certainly politically entrenched. According to President Eisenhower's children, the penultimate draft of his famous speech referred to the military-industrial congressional complex. But he removed the word congressional when advisers said it would cause him and his successors political difficulty. Congress remains important in boosting military budgets. The military-industrial part of the complex is not all-powerful, but it has astutely dispersed investment and jobs widely across states and congressional districts. The F-22 Raptor fighter plane alone has 240 subcontractors called major ones, spread through 37 states. The final 2006 defense budget also contained an astonishing number, 15,000 earmarks, designed to benefit particular states and congressional districts. About 30% of all earmarks in congressional bills are said to be in defense bills. Bases, businesses, and earmarks are spread fairly evenly, ensuring bipartisan support. Given the entrenched powers of the branches of the military, it's also difficult to make selective cuts, cutting one more rather than another. But the Cold War is also responsible for quite a lot, and it's remained, some of its presuppositions remain. It began, of course, immediately after World War II, and so armed force levels in the U.S. did not decline from the World War peak as much as might have been expected. The Cold War also took on the ideological legacy of 20th century European wars, especially the Second World War, which had become struggles between entire ways of life. The Cold War was between capitalism and communism, democracy and authoritarianism, and communism was opposed to our way of life. So it was more difficult to negotiate compromises with such an enemy. After the Soviet collapse, this labeling carried on, carried over, as rogue states were quickly identified by a democratic administration. These were not just enemies, they were war criminals flouting international laws and norms. President Bush the Younger then converted this into the axis of evil. The war on terror is also said to be a war against people who oppose our entire way of life, now considered as democracy and affluence. They resent our wealth, our materialism. Yet this one is false, regardless of what the other two were. What they wanted to do is to change our foreign policy so they could live their own way of life without us and attack their own governments without us. Bin Laden has not mentioned our way of life. The final Cold War legacy was the way it ended, with Soviet collapse. A myth grew up, mainly but not entirely among Republicans, that Ronald Reagan had caused the Soviet collapse through his toughness. Most Soviet experts say problems internal to the Soviet Union, Soviet bloc, were more important. I mean, though this is hotly debated. Yet in America, it's the myth that counts, and we should remember that if men define situations as real, they are real in their consequences, as a sociologist said 80 years ago. The consequence was to boost confidence in military pressure as the default mode. If we can knock over the Soviet Union, we can easily knock over more minor enemies. Idealistic neoconservatives added the notion that we can restructure the world and make it a better place. Democrats sigh and say we are the world's policemen, we have certain obligations, but we can fulfill them because we are strong enough. There's consensus that problems across the world are our problems, though I don't see why if they don't affect our interests. The wars of the 1990s added some encouragement to this. Somalia was a negative case, a failure, but it seemed to teach that we shouldn't intervene in a half-hearted way. Clinton also wavered in the Yugoslav wars. Nonetheless, the result was a success. We forced Milosevic to back down, and this precipitated his fall from power. We also got the Russians to back down, and Serbia had long been considered by them as in their own sphere of interest. Yet our success was in tandem with Croat, Bosnian, and Kosovo Albanian forces on the ground. That is, they were ready to form governments when we forced the Serbs to retreat. We were also, in a sense, ratifying the consequences of the prior local wars, aiding what was by then a lamentable, perhaps, but the best available solution, a series of ethnically cleansed states in the former territories of Yugoslavia, a process which is coming to completion in Kosovo now. But the lesson many drew, especially Republicans, was that if you do intervene, do it wholeheartedly with enough resources to do the job quickly. This is also your solution too, having been the commander. So the progress of the 1990s increased the notion that we could do it if we used all our resources. But of course, then under the Bush administration, we saw the limitations of what we can do. The limitations are very considerable in the 21st century because we can no longer, in many parts of the world, rely on client elites of the right, because we are not faced by a threat which seems to come from the left. And the growth of nationalism, the resilience of other world religions, is something that we simply do not have the resources to take on. It's not a question of military force, but what happens politically afterwards. And what happens politically afterwards depends on whether the initial invasion has the support of substantial numbers of locals, which is highly unlikely in the case of Iran, and not very likely in many other places. Of course, Korea is a more complex situation. Culture and institutions affect the people too. Most Americans will say in polls that they favor peace over war, and they deny having an empire or being militaristic. But they do say they're proud of being number one, proud of global dominance, eager to use it to improve the world, and proud of the armed forces. we support our troops, is the bumper sticker. The armed forces are much more prominent in public life and the media, favorably presented, than in any other country I know. American culture is rather pro-military. So what seems to be going on here is that there is some kind of contradiction between what would seem on the one hand to be realist reason and on the other hand entrenched culture and institutions inherited from the past, projected into the future, now given a bloody nose, but perhaps still not producing the kind of extended reaction which there should be. Reason, realist reason, would surely support a smaller military, a lowering of actions which produce blowback, a withdrawal from countries which are not of vital interest to us, a resort to market power, not military power in economic matters. Neoliberalism is good, and the replacement of war by diplomacy and carrots as the default mode. Multilateralism will become absolutely vital when, it's not yet, when the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and perhaps a more consolidated European Union, when they become genuine economic power rivals of the US. Better to prepare for that gracefully rather than remain as a rogue state with less economic power but still with massive military resources which you're willing to use. Interestingly enough, the BRICS, apart from Russia, have much lower institutions and culture of militarism. It's likely that the US doesn't have to be so insecure about life after empire. Life might still be free and affluent. Thank you.
Robert and Cal, thanks very much for the opportunity to be with you. And Michael, I just want to compliment you.